I'm delighted now to welcome back to the program Geshe Lobsang Tenzin Negi. He is director of the Emory-Tibet Partnership, which includes a science initiative, which we will talk about, and he is the co-director of the Emory Collaborative of Contemplative Studies. He studied at the Drepung Losaling Monastery in India, where he was awarded the Geshe Larampa degree, and he earned his PhD at Emory University. He's spiritual director of the Drepung Losaling Monastery branch in Atlanta. And this Friday, the 21st of December, at 5:30, he will be giving a talk at Surrett and Sons called Spirituality in the New World. That's on Sandoval Street next to Alpine Sports. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Thank you for having me back.
So you are in the remarkable position of having a deep understanding of two paradigms, the Tibetan Buddhism and the Western scientific paradigms. What are some of the ways in which these two ways of observing the world are compatible?
I would not claim that I have much expertise in the scientific field, but I did have an opportunity to study some of the Western science, particularly it relates to emotions and certain aspects of contemplative practices. I think that among other areas, one of the most relevant and important area would be in understanding emotions, the human emotions or the emotions, and how they impact on our health and well-being. And I think that's an area both scientists and contemplatives are very interested at this point to collaborate and see how they can contribute to each other's understanding.
So how do you observe that, and how do you collaborate with scientists who are observing human emotions?
Well, one of the programs under Emory-Tibet Partnership we have initiated is called Cognitively Based Compassion Training. It's a program for doing research on compassion practice, but also how to bring that into the education. So in that field, I had the good opportunity to collaborate with my scientific colleagues at Emory University, like the Dr. Chuck Rezan, who is a very good expert in the field of emotions, particularly the depression and also looking into the very biochemical processes that contribute towards some of our modern day illnesses. So we designed a study program called the CBCT, or the Cognitive-Based Compassion Training. And back in 2005, we started that program with undergraduate students at Emory University, freshman students. For five semesters, we did a research to see if those who are in meditation and doing meditation on compassion, if they differ from the control group or those who don't practice much, even though they show up in the classes, in terms of certain reduction in certain biochemical processes that are associated with the depression and the kind of the chronic stress and so forth. So for example, two specific biochemicals, like one, it's an immune inflammation cell called interleukin-6 or IL-6, and the other one is a kind of the classic stress hormone, cortisol. And this initial study showed that certainly students who were designated as high practice, meaning that who came to the classes and actually put some time to practice, they were significantly different from the control or the group that is referred to as the low practice group.
So meditation actually works in Western terms to reduce depression and stress and things like that.
I think that there is a growing recognition now that the meditation, like compassion or mindfulness, these are they play quite significant role in how we see the world around, how we see the challenges in our own life, and therefore that helps respond or react to those situations differently in ways that are not characteristic of a stressful reaction. So in that way, you can say that these contemplative or the meditative states can help lower certain processes that are associated with depression or other modern-day illnesses.
And so these are the same kinds of, it's a therapy that other people might take pills and drugs for.
That's right, yes. And I think that while medications like the drugs, Prozac and so forth, are of course very important for those who are going through some serious depression or other forms of mental illnesses. But I think that some change in our perspective, in other words, how we see the situation around us, how we relate to others, whether at our workplace or in our own families or in the world around, they inform in very significant ways that how our body reacts to those situations.
So science, as I understand it, I'm certainly not a scientist, is fundamentally about matter and energy. And from that perspective, matter, stuff, molecules, compounds, give rise to mind, to our minds. But as I understand it, from the Buddhist perspective, it's very different. What is mind from a Buddhist perspective, and what is its relationship to matter and the physical body?
I think that it's probably accurate to say that the modern science, when it comes to its position on mind, and the Eastern philosophy, including Buddhism, when it comes to understanding mind and its nature and function, probably have very fundamental differences when it comes to the basic paradigm to discuss the nature of the mind. But I think that in one way it's true that the modern science, at least in the mainstream modern science, takes the position that the mind is an emergent property, purely from the certain interactions of the material processes. And the Eastern philosophy, the Buddhist philosophy, the Buddhist tradition, on the other hand, sees that the mind is not purely a kind of accidental product of the interaction of molecules and like that, but rather the mind has its kind of distinct nature that arises from the previous moment of mental experience. And so in that way, that there may be a fundamental difference when it comes to the basic paradigm. But I think that there is a lot of overlap, commonality in these two traditions when we try to understand what kind of, how a certain mental state, let's say attention, for example, that how it is understood, how it manifests in relation to certain brain activity and so forth. Although Buddhist tradition would not talk about the brain activity specifically, but while Buddhist tradition explains what is attention and how it is cultivated and the processes for enhancing it, the modern science can actually try to study this through the changes and activities of the brain, and therefore that come to a better understanding about what the attention is and how, most importantly, how we can improve it, which is, I think, that the most important part for us is not just to know what they are, but how we can develop it and enhance it. And that is an area where I think that the Buddhist tradition, as a contemplative tradition that has dedicated millennia in understanding these inner processes and enhancing them, cultivating them, when it comes together with the modern science that also tries to understand these processes through the brain activity and the chemical changes and so forth, I think that there's a lot to complement to each other.
Yeah, I'm sure there's a lot to complement to each other, and it seems to me that on some level the Buddhist traditions have mastered what Western science might call changing your brain chemistry for the better and all of that. But let's talk for a moment about the ways, leaving Western science behind completely for a moment. What is mind? In Buddhism, this concept of mind comes up, and what is it? Does it exist independently from human existence? Is there a mind across the entire universe? Is it a fundamentally human phenomenon?
Mind is actually not just one single entity. From Buddhist perspective, certainly the mind includes all the different aspects of our experience, whether it's the sensory perceptions, emotional states, you know, thought, memories. All these inner experiences are referred to as mind. Now, the mind is not unique to humans. Buddhist tradition actually believes that all living beings, including insects and so forth, every living being possesses something called the mind. And the mind is characterized as an entity that is capable of engaging with certain content, information, and capable of processing it. But in its own nature is something called the clear or the luminous. So luminous and cognizance is these two kind of the parts are the basic nature of the mind. And from this perspective, the Buddhist belief is that each individual, like us, each human or animal, each one has a specific kind of stream of mind or the consciousness. And the Buddhist belief is that each one of us has had infinite lifetimes previously. There's no absolute beginning to the emergence of mind, of any individual stream of the mind.
Right.
So that's the kind of the Buddhist belief. So Buddhists actually don't necessarily believe that there is one kind of cosmic consciousness that every other mind streams, individual mind streams are sort of the, the part of it. That position is not quite Buddhist. Buddhists believe that each individual has a specific mind stream, but the basic nature of the mind is same, in the sense that it's, if you think of at its most primordial or the basic level, the nature of the mind is uncorrupted. It is free of any obscurations or the stains. But out of our misconceptions, lack of awareness, the veils of that ignorance are created, and then when we see the world through those veils of distortion, the confusion, the ignorance, and other emotions, attachment, anger, jealousy, then identify with such projections, then there are obviously results that come out of that are not particularly helpful and beneficial for the individuals or the society.
Would you attribute qualities like confusion and ignorance and anger and jealousy and things like that to insects or dogs, or is that a specifically human thing?
Ignorance, it's understood as the kind of the one of the most fundamental kinds of obscuration of the mind that any ordinary living being, including insects, go through. And so this is not a unique kind of the feature of a human mind.
So when a mosquito bites you, it's just being a mosquito. It doesn't have any other choices. But when humans hurt each other, they have all sorts of choices. So it seems like it's really different.
That's the thing, that the ignorance, on the one hand, it may simply mean that just not aware of the reality, the actual situation. Ignorance, on the other hand, can also mean it's looking at the world in a certain way that does not conform to the actual reality. So it's true that unlike human beings with developed brain and brain function and a lot of cognitive abilities and the reasoning and thoughts and so forth, that we make many of our kind of decision based on the reasoning and the decision making and so forth, which may be not that elaborate for more basic forms of organism like mosquitoes and so forth. But I think that and from that perspective, that how they respond or react to the situation may be different than how an individual equipped with a certain enhanced ability to interpret or assess the situation in a different light, you know, it will be different. But simply the fact that that certain basic organism may just react to the situation in an instinctual way, from the Buddhist point of view, does not mean that their actions are not informed by certain the mental states that may be in some ways out of touch with the reality.
We're talking to Geshe Lobsang Tenzin Negi about Tibetan spirituality and Western consciousness. And I think there seems in our society to be an apparent conflict between science and spirituality. It's always framed that way, and I don't always feel comfortable with that framing, but I think the issue is that there is an experience or a phenomenon that people experience that they call spirituality, and those things are not considered to be observable or measurable by Western science. But I wondered what your perspective is. I mean, are there things that maybe eventually can be measured that can't be measured now, but that people now call spirituality?
I think that this, what we mean by spirituality, it includes the very basic human values like compassion, empathy, you know, the caring for others, love, forgiveness, generosity. These are all included in spirituality. I mean, His Holiness the Dalai Lama has written extensively, like through his books, like The Ethics for the New Millennium, or most recently, the book entitled Beyond Religion, The Ethics for the Whole World. In these books, you know, based on his extensive interaction with modern scientists, he is very comfortable at presenting these basic human values as spiritual qualities, the qualities that are actually skills that individuals can get better at. And the modern science, like the works of the renowned neuroscientist Dr. Richard Davidson and others, are clearly demonstrating that the compassion or the attention, the mindfulness, you know, these are the qualities that you can get better. That's in a study that they have done with novice practitioners from some cooperation. They were able to show that the certain brain activity that are associated with a certain degree of compassion, actually that the gamma waves, as they refer to it, even in kind of novice meditators within 8 weeks of training, that they show a certain increase in those brain activity. Of course, in adept meditators who have meditated for over 10,000 hours, you know, that most of these are the meditators from Tibetan Buddhist tradition. When they were brought to his lab in Wisconsin and then were put into the in that fMRI machine, and when their brain activities are measured, I mean, they're, you know, those activities
off the
are
charts.
Way, you know, high. So what it shows is that these basic qualities of mind, which could be referred to as basic human values, they are skills. You can train them, you can get better at it. And I think that that's is the most exciting part right now, you know, in these collaborations between the scientists and the contemplatives themselves, that to see the potential for, you know, understanding these processes and the ways to improve them, so that with increased qualities of compassion and so forth, certainly that there are many benefits that we can see for individuals and on the social level.
So these again are ways in which, and maybe this is because this is what you do all day, is where the Tibetan and the Western come together, but there are still things that are, I mean, completely different. For example, the idea that the Buddha at a certain point remembered his past lives. What is that? How does that work? I mean, do we understand? So, for example, the idea that I will die and then I will come back as something or somebody else, a dog or another person or whatever. What is the I that comes back? I mean, it certainly isn't my name, my ethnicity, my body, my eye color, my parents, my experience. It's none of those things.
That's true. And I think that you know, it would be naive to think that everything Buddhist belief or claim about that those could be topic for the scientific inquiry. I think that there are areas of certainly that at this point or perhaps never will be the really this kind of the field for scientific inquiry.
Or maybe they will.
Or maybe, you know, that those, you know, we basically don't know at this point. You know, like for example, like the reincarnation, that what continues, you know, from this life to next, if anything. You know, those are not something that at this point that the scientists, at least in the kind of mainstream scientists, are really looking at. But
from a Buddhist perspective.
But from the Buddhist perspective, yes. Buddhist tradition has held this, you know, always that an individual, you know, like you and I, we are a collection of many different things that what in Buddhism we call skandhas or the aggregates, you know, basically various psychophysical processes. You know, we have this body that in that body made of this millions of the, you know, the different chemicals and so forth. And there are certain mental processes. That was, we have sensation, we have perception, we have thought, emotions. And the human identity is a mental construct. You know, something that is designated to these mental biophysical processes, and therefore that the identity is not fixed. You know, that is not just one unchanging fixed entity that remains unchanging throughout our life, or from the Buddhist point of view, from one life to another. With the changing the factors, our identity changes. You know, that we are children at the babies at certain age, that we grow into the teenagers, the adults, we become, you know, old, and or we are you know, children, we can become parents, teachers. You know, all the, these different kind of identity that we create are dependent on the other factors. And so therefore what it tells is that an identity, human identity, you know, that as self is something that is designated. It does not exist fixed and as fixed unchanging entity in and of itself, but it is something of a mental construct. So based on that, Buddhist tradition maintains that our certain kind of processes upon which we create the identity as we, as persons and self and so forth. Some of these processes endure, you know, beyond this life, not as the fixed unchanging entity, but like a stream, like a river that can, you know, originate at a certain mountain and then flow through the different states you know, into the ocean. Similarly, the mental stream, the mind stream, if you will, it's not one single entity, but again, it's characterized by the mere cognizance and luminosity, and it's that entity, if you will, that makes it possible to, for one to engage or to register and process information. And that mental stream, although changing moment by moment, each moment it's changing, but it continues throughout our life. And even when our current life as it is, even when it ends, the mental stream continues. So all that memories, the experience that we built in this life and have built in the previous lives also, the mental stream is what that conserves all that memories, or the, in Buddhist context you can call karma, you know, the karmic imprint. And so you could think of that in here, based on a certain physical properties, processes, we can say that we are humans. after this life ends, when the mind, mental consciousness continues, the mental stream continues, and its karmic process is kind of directed to take a life form in a, let's say, a cockroach, then, you know, I would be cockroach there. And then that as a cockroach dies, that it's the mental processes of all the different karmic imprints and so forth from, you know, infinite lifetimes. That's, it's possible that one of the karmic imprints that is that directs the such life continuum to some fortunate life form, once again the human being and so forth, that it is such a mind stream when it then, you know, conceives in a kind of the fertilized egg, and then there is the human you know, human birth again, you know, the human conception. Our identity is very fluid. It's
based well, that's what I'm wondering. I mean, okay, let's say a person's conscious stream of mind continues past the end of their life in some form whose scientific quality we don't have words for, but I'm sure you do have words for them in Sanskrit. But then is the next life made up of, let's say it's one person, let's say it's me, is it just made up of the previous stream of me, or does it also consist of grass and trees and other people and animals that all go into that next life? In other words, is there a kind of individual continuity that is not connected to all the other individual?
Well, it is connected and not connected in the sense that there is nothing that exists just by itself from the Buddhist point of view. We are all, each one of us, is, you know, connected with everything around us in this infinite web of interconnectedness. You know, that so that is there. Now, to think about like that, you know, from yesterday to today, we are making a transition from yesterday, or even moment by moment. You know, that hour to hour, or moment by moment, there is a transition, there is a change. Now, to what degree, you know, how different that change? It depends on the so many circumstances, the factors around. You know, that from this moment to next moment, if the our bodies are, you know, even though under the kind of the microscope, it's not the same. You know, two moments, but nonetheless, there is a seeming continuity, and so therefore that we can feel that yes, I'm still the same person based on the bodily factors and so forth. They are, you know, seemingly kind of the similar. So
and
so
your memories and
the memories and the yeah all those things and then the relationships, the kind of the
right.
You know, the job, the environment and so forth. So you know, all when they are all seeming kind of the somewhat in a similar position, that it gives a perception that we are the same being, you know, that so that what I'm trying to say is that the transition from one life to another, you know, that is from the Buddhist point of view, it's not seen as like a bean that is kind of jumping from one table to next table, not like that.
Okay.
You know, it's more like the mental stream. It's mental stream. It's ultimately it is connected with energy. You know, it's information, if you will. The mind and energy are inextricably linked. It's actually, in fact, the two faces of the same kind of entity, if you will. So therefore, you could think of it, you know, not necessarily like a single entity jumping, but rather a flow, a stream, a flow. And from this life to next life, where you end up, you know, which direction, with the trajectory, it's to some certain extent determined by the conditions of this life and, the, you know, that before dying, that that energy mind complex is what kind of forces are activated, you know, that will direct such a mind-body stream, a mind-energy stream, you know, towards which life form that they will take place. And but once such a conception is made, then it's not just that such an individual will grow only based on the previous life's karma and the experience, but rather the environment in which such a conception has taken place. You know, even like the genetic information of the father and mother's, you know, the drops, you know, the very the fluids, and all that come into play, but also the environment, you know, like that the air, the warmth, the nutrition, the, you know, that furthers that mother's mental states, the father's, the people around them also, that how they influence, and then the, certainly that the food, you know, that is necessary. So it's right. It's a complex kind of web of interconnectedness. It's this kind of the, this is in one way, I kind of sometimes wonder, you know, the debate that we have in the West sometimes, that, you know, what determines that how we grow, whether it's the nature or the nurture, you know, the debate nature and nurture, whether it's the genes or the environment, and as it has become clear that it's both, you know, that it is the genes, but also the environment that shapes. The same way that it's a previous karmic information, and the all that information, that's also one part, but also the environment, you know, that you grow in, it all have all play important role in shaping our experience and how we grow as individuals.
We're talking to Tibetan Buddhist teacher Geshe Lobsang Tenzin Negi, director of the Emory Tibet Partnership. The idea that karma extends back infinitely, that every life is influenced by the one before, which is influenced by the one before. In Western tradition, we have a beginning, which is the age of the earth, and then the primordial soup, and then the first cell, however that came about. What about in Buddhist thinking? Is there any conception of the beginning of at least life on earth or something before that?
Yes, beginning of a specific world system, there are kind of origin stories, certainly, that, you know, in Buddhism as well. But I think that Buddhism also maintains is that a world system may emerge based on whether it's Big Bang or, you know, the whatever factors kind of that contribute towards the emergence of the world system, solar systems, and so forth, the whole universe. But it's an individual universe still that has its, that owes its emergence to the factors that lie before them. And therefore that Buddhist tradition maintains that this like individual consciousness that has no absolute beginning, similarly our world systems, individual world systems, has a beginning and end. But to say that before this time there was nothing existed, that's not the Buddhist position. Buddhism maintains that there are many worlds. I mean, there are many world systems. Not only that, many dimensions that we can see and interact with the kind of the dimension that wherewith we have the mindset to perceive and interact. But you know, there could be multiple kind of dimensions. Even in this room, you know, that we see it as a room, another living being with a different kind of, seeing from a different lens, different, you know, the apparatus may see it totally as completely another, you know, different place. So from that perspective, that it goes back to the same, that the mind has no absolute beginning for individual mind stream. Similarly, that the universes as they exist, you know, that there is no absolute beginning to existence, and you know, it's just simply says that there, if there is a result, there must be a cause. You know, the results come from causes.
Right. So something caused the Big Bang, and there was something there before that.
Right.
And cosmologists say that may be fine, but we don't know, and
right,
they don't go there.
Yeah.
And but at the same time, I mean, it seems to me that Buddhist practice and thinking is not so much about the origins of stars and the universe, but of life.
Yes.
And specifically about the kind of conscious life that we live.
Yes.
Which is, I think, maybe not, kind of bound to this earth that we're living on. And at that point, there was kind of some earthly beginning.
Yes. Of course, that the main mission of the Buddha was to understand suffering and how to alleviate suffering. You know, that's what he said, that I teach about the suffering and the way out of the suffering. And so that's the kind of the primary, you know, the mission, if you will. But of course, to address what the suffering is, how we understand what kind of conditions promote suffering, certainly that it involves a certain understanding about our nature, you know, that the world that we live in, the way it's and then also some, you know, position about that how the life began on this earth, at least, even though it's not the absolute beginning of the life, you know, but how this universe formed and where the life began. And some of these things, you know, particularly when it comes to kind of understanding our cosmos and like that, in the material kind of the existence, Buddhism may not have very kind of elaborate or elaborate information or understanding. I mean, that that's one of the things that His Holiness the Dalai Lama is so keen in collaborating with the scientists, is that science and Buddhism both, in many ways, are very similar. You know, they are interested in kind of exploring, understanding what is reality. You know, that not the one truth, but the actuality of the situation. You know, that our own suffering, our happiness, the world, material world, and so forth. So, when it comes to understanding many of these external factors, whether our world system, whether how far the moon and the sun, and whether the moon is kind of revolving around the earth or not, those things, some of these, or the sun, you know, the earth is revolving around the sun or not, in some of these things, the Buddhism may not be Buddhism may not have quite accurate answer. And then the Holiness the Dalai Lama is the first one to say that actually that if the science presents very conclusive evidence against some of the positions held by Buddhists should give it up and then accept what is kind of empirically, you know, proved to be the case.
Right. And at the same time, one wonders whether Western scientists will accept the places where Buddhism is stronger.
Yeah. I mean, I think that in some areas, at this point at least, the scientists probably would not go, you know, like the reincarnation in this area. I think that it's a... But then there are many areas...
But also just the wisdom traditions. Mm. I mean, I'm not sure... And I'm really not sure whether science has a wisdom tradition. Mm-hmm. It has. It measures things.
Right. Well, I mean, the science is done by individuals again. You know that. So that you have individuals who are kind of faithful to the scientific, you know, method of inquiry. You know that. But then they also come with a certain set of their own you know, background and the mindset. And I think that the there are certain scientists, I mean, that who, you know, throughout the scientific history, that who have stepped out of what was kind of the standard, you know, the scientific tradition or the assumptions, and you know, in many cases made the new discoveries. And I think that I'm not suggesting that the modern science should rush to you know, to look into the afterlife and the some of the things that that may not be studied at this point scientifically. But I think that the main point is that there is so much to understand about our human condition, you know, that the conditions that can really make a difference whether we flourish and our you know, next generation survive or not. And those are not only exploring external material kind of the reality, material, you know, discovering new medicines and so forth and so on, those are very important. But also they are equally, you know, crucial, are understanding our own mindset, you know, that these basic human values of compassion and the mindfulness, attention, these are also so important. And I think that in this area that there is a growing, you know, collaboration between scientists and the contemplatives to understand this better, to enhance our human condition.
How has it affected you as a person, as a Tibetan person, to be so immersed in the kind of Western university scientific world that you're living in?
I think that, you know, I have over the years come to really appreciate the efforts that the scientists are making and the Buddhists are making, I mean, led by His Holiness Dalai Lama himself, no other than His Holiness Dalai Lama themselves, to really to work together to you know, while understanding that there are some fundamental differences, but to work together to understand it was our own workings of the mind, emotions, better, so that we can you know, in some ways make contribution to a better future. And I think that has been very, very inspiring. And you know, what little involvement I've had in this programs, I feel that this has been an incredible opportunity for me as per, you know, individually.
I can't help but thinking when I look at the different systems that you're working in, and forgive me, audience, for saying this, but in a sense it seems to me that it's sort of like a big brother, little brother thing. Like the Tibetan system is so old and so profound and so well studied over 2.5 millennia, and Western science is fairly new and recent and has a lot of power, a lot of ability to do good and to do harm, but isn't really very emotionally mature, and that one has the effect to raise the other in terms of maturity, even as the other has tools that the ancient system might not have.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think that that's the point. I think our knowledge, you know, our understanding, as His Holiness Dalai Lama has pointed out, that it's like a tool, you know, that we can use a tool for good purpose or bad purpose. Nuclear power, if you will. I mean, that discovering the nuclear energy, that one can use it to create nuclear bomb and to you know, destroy life, or use it to, you know, create energy and to provide electricity and to improve the human life. So I think that what is crucial is that good heart. You know, that can we find a way to become better in terms of our empathy for others, compassion for others. And I think that in that area, I feel that the Tibetan Buddhist tradition has a lot to offer. And but you know, these insights are gained primarily through first-person experience, first-person exploration. And I think that there is a tremendous, you know, the power when something is demonstrated through the third-person perspective as well. You know, that through the scientific, kind of the modern scientific methodology. And I think that that's what is kind of encouraging to see, that in some of those areas, the scientists are making progress in understanding, and the Buddhist tradition, the contemplative tradition, it actually in all, you know, spiritual traditions, I think that the Buddhist tradition has had a long history of very meticulously kind of the observing these inner experiences, kind of making charts, you know, and then creating the instructions as to how to enhance them. So in that way, that I think that you know, in some of those areas, we have an opportunity now. You know, it's a kind of exciting period, really, that where to bring that the external scientific tools to actually make sense of some of these experiential aspects of our life that the other traditions, like this contemplative traditions, have you know, devoted their time and energy millennia to kind of better understand. And I think that the when this first-person approach and the third-person approach both come together to kind of you know, to present a better understanding of some of these our inner experiences, and that will make a difference in our society.
Geshe Lobsang Tenzin Negi is director of the Emory Tibet Partnership, and he will be speaking this Friday, tomorrow, December 21st at 5:30 at Surrett and Sons, which is at 121 Sandoval Street here in Santa Fe, next to Alpine Sports. The lecture is titled Spirituality in the New World. And by the way, there are all sorts of activities going on. There's a mandala sand painting going on at Surrett and Sons Gallery, and that is happening through New Year's Eve, although I think they'll be away for, they'll be here until the 21st, and then again from the 26th to the 30th, and you can go observe the sand painting. And there will also be a sacred music and dance performance on Saturday, December 22nd, at the Taos Center for the Arts at 7 in the evening. And in addition to that, there will be a Medicine Buddha Puja on Sunday morning, the 23rd of December, at the Mabel Dodge Lujan House classroom building in Taos. That's at 9:30 in the morning, and then at 2 in the afternoon, the monks will be blessing the waters at Ojo Caliente. So lots of good things going on. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.